It would be expensive. And there would be no point in it. His families were on excellent terms with each other and exchanged the usual greetings on birthdays and anniversaries. Yet, on the whole, perhaps it was just as well that the girls had never met, and probably never would. Myrna had been born on Mars, and so could not tolerate the high gravity of Earth. And Caroline hated even the 25 minutes of the longest possible terrestrial journey. "Sorry I'm a day late with this transmission," said Norton, after he had finished the general-purpose preliminaries. "But I've been away from the ship for the last 30 hours, believe it or not." "Don't be alarmed. Everything is under control, going perfectly. It's taken us 2 days, but we're almost through the airlock complex. We could have done it in a couple of hours if we'd known what we do now. But we took no chances, sent remote cameras ahead, and cycled all the locks 12 times to make sure they wouldn't seize up behind us, after we'd gone through. Each lock is a simple revolving cylinder with a slot on one side. You go in through this opening, crank the cylinder around 180 degrees, and the slot then matches up with another door so you can step out of it. Or float, in this case. The Ramans really made sure of things. There are 3 of these cylinder locks, one after the other, just inside the outer hull and below the entry pillbox. I can't imagine how even one would fail unless someone blew it up with explosives, but if it did, there would be a second backup and then a third. And that's only the beginning. The final lock opens into a straight corridor, almost 0.5 kilometer long. It looks clean and tidy, like everything else we've seen. Every few meters there are small ports that probably held lights, but now everything is completely black. And, I don't mind telling you, scary. There are also 2 parallel slots, about 1 centimeter wide, cut in the walls and running the whole length of the tunnel. We suspect that some kind of shuttle runs inside these, to tow equipment, or people, back and forth. It would save us a lot of trouble if we could get it working. I mentioned that the tunnel was 0.5 kilometer long. Well, from our seismic soundings, we knew that that's about the thickness of the shell, so obviously we were almost through it. And at the end of the tunnel, we weren't surprised to find another of those cylindrical airlocks. Yes. And another. And another. These people seem to have done everything in threes. We're in the final lock chamber now, waiting for the okay from Earth before we go through. The interior of Rama is only a few meters away. I'll be a lot happier when the suspense is over. You know Jerry Kirchhoff, my exec, who's got such a library of real books that he can't afford to emigrate from Earth? Well, Jerry told me about a situation just like this, back at the beginning of the 20th century. An archaeologist found the tomb of an Egyptian king, the first one that hadn't been looted by robbers. His workmen took months to dig their way in, chamber by chamber, until they came to the final wall. Then they broke through the masonry, and he held out a lantern and pushed his head inside. He found himself looking into a whole room full of treasure. Incredible stuff, gold and jewels. Perhaps this place is also a tomb. It seems more and more likely. Even now, there's still not the slightest sound or hint of any activity. Well, tomorrow we should know. Norton switched the recorder to hold. What else, he wondered, should he say about the work, before he began the separate personal messages to his families? Normally, he never went into so much detail, but these circumstances were scarcely normal. This might be the last gram he would ever send to those he loved. He owed it to them to explain what he was doing. By the time they saw these images and heard these words, he would be inside Rama, for better or for worse. 8. Through the hub. Never before had Norton felt so strongly his kinship with that long-dead Egyptologist. Not since Howard Carter had first peered into the tomb of Tutankhamen could any man have known a moment such as this. Yet the comparison was almost ridiculously ludicrous. Tutankhamen had been buried only yesterday, not even 4,000 years ago. Rama might be older than mankind. That little tomb in the Valley of the Kings could have been lost in the corridors through which they had already passed, but the space that lay beyond this final seal was at least a million times greater. And as for the treasure it might hold, that was beyond imagination. No one had spoken over the radio circuits for at least 5 minutes. The well-trained team had not even reported verbally when all the checks were complete. Mercer had simply given him the OK sign and waved him toward the open tunnel. It was as if everyone realized that this was a moment for history, not to be spoiled by unnecessary small talk. That suited Norton, for at the moment he, too, had nothing to say. He flicked on the beam of his flashlight, triggered his jets, and drifted slowly down the short corridor, trailing his safety line behind him. Only seconds later, he was inside. Inside what? All before him was total darkness. Not a glimmer of light was reflected back from the beam. He had expected this, but he had not really believed it. All the calculations had shown that the far wall was tens of kilometers away. Now his eyes told him that this was indeed the truth. As he drifted slowly into that darkness, he felt a sudden need for the reassurance of his safety line, stronger than any he had ever experienced before, even on his first EVA. And that was ridiculous. He had looked out across the light years and the megaparsecs without vertigo. Why should he be disturbed by a few cubic kilometers of emptiness? He was queasily brooding over this problem when the momentum damper at the end of the line braked him gently to a halt, with a barely perceptible rebound. He swept the vainly probing beam of the flashlight down from the nothingness ahead to examine the surface from which he had emerged. He might have been hovering over the center of a small crater, which was itself a dimple in the base of a much larger one. On either side rose a complex of terraces and ramps, all geometrically precise and obviously artificial, which extended for as far as the beam could reach. About 100 meters away, he could see the exits of the other two airlock systems, identical with this one. And that was all. There was nothing particularly exotic or alien about the scene. In fact, it bore a considerable resemblance to an abandoned mine. He felt a vague sense of disappointment. After all this effort, there should have been some dramatic, even transcendental, revelation. Then he reminded himself that he could see only a couple of 100 meters. The darkness beyond his field of view might yet contain more wonders than he cared to face. He reported briefly to his anxiously waiting companions, then added, "I'm sending out the flare. 2-minute delay. Here goes." With all his strength, he threw the little cylinder straight upward, or outward, and started to count seconds as it dwindled along the beam. Before he had reached the quarter minute, it was out of sight. When he had got to 100, he shielded his eyes and aimed the camera. He had always been good at estimating time. He was only 2 seconds off when the world exploded with light, and this time there was no cause for disappointment. Even the millions of candle power of the flare could not light up the whole of this enormous cavity, but he could see enough to grasp its plan and appreciate its titanic scale. He was at one end of a hollow cylinder at least 10 kilometers wide and of indefinite length. From his viewpoint at the central axis, he could see such a mass of detail on the curving walls surrounding him that his mind could not absorb more than a minute fraction of it. He was looking at the landscape of an entire world by a single flash of lightning, and he tried, by a deliberate effort of will, to freeze the image in his mind. All around him, the terraced slopes of crater rose up until they merged into the solid wall that rimmed the sky. No, that impression was false. He must discard the instincts both of Earth and of space, and reorientate himself to a new system of coordinates. He was not at the lowest point of this strange, inside-out world, but the highest. From here, all directions were down, not up. If he moved away from this central axis toward the curving wall, which he must no longer think of as a wall, gravity would steadily increase. When he reached the inside surface of the cylinder, he could stand upright on it at any point, feet toward the stars, and head toward the center of the spinning drum. The concept was familiar enough. Since the earliest dawn of spaceflight, centrifugal force had been used to simulate gravity. It was only the scale of this application that was so overwhelming, so shocking. The largest of all space stations, SyncSat 5, was less than 200 meters in diameter. It would take some little while to grow accustomed to 100 times that size. The tube of landscape that enclosed him was mottled with areas of light and shade that could have been forests, fields, frozen lakes, or towns. The distance and the fading illumination of the flare made identification impossible. Narrow lines that could be highways, canals, or well-trained rivers formed a faintly visible geometrical network, and far along the cylinder, at the very limit of vision, was a band of deeper darkness. It formed a complete circle, ringing the interior of this world, and Norton suddenly recalled the myth of Oceanus, the sea that, the ancients believed, surrounded the earth. Here, perhaps, was an even stranger sea, not circular, but cylindrical. Before it became frozen in the interstellar night, did it have waves and tides and currents and fish? The flare guttered and died. The moment of revelation was over. But Norton knew that as long as he lived, these images would be burned in his mind. Whatever discoveries the future might bring, they could never erase this first impression. And history could never take from him the privilege of being the first of all mankind to gaze upon the works of an alien civilization. 9. Reconnaissance. We have now launched 5 long delay flares down the axis of the cylinder, and so have a good photo coverage of its full length. All the main features are mapped. Though there are few that we can identify, we've given them provisional names. The interior cavity is 50 kilometers long and 16 wide. The two ends are bowl-shaped, with rather complicated geometries. We've called ours the Northern Hemisphere and are establishing our first base here at the axis. Radiating from the central hub, 12 degrees apart, are 3 ladders that are almost a kilometer long. They all end at a terrace, or ring-shaped plateau, that runs right around the bowl. And leading on from that, continuing the direction of the ladders, are 3 enormous stairways, which go all the way down to the plain. If you imagine an umbrella with only 3 ribs, equally spaced, you'll have a good idea of this end of Rama. Each of those ribs is a stairway, very steep near the axis, and then slowly flattening out as it approaches the plain below. The stairways, we've called them Alpha, Beta, Gamma, aren't continuous, but break at 5 more circular terraces. We estimate there must be between 20,000 and 30,000 steps. Presumably they were used only for emergencies, since it's inconceivable that the Ramans, or whatever we're going to call them, had no better way of reaching the axis of their world. The southern hemisphere looks quite different. For one thing, it has no stairways and no flat central hub. Instead, there's a huge spike, kilometers long, jutting along the axis, with 6 smaller ones around it. The whole arrangement is very odd, and we can't imagine what it means. The 50-kilometer-long cylindrical section between the 2 bowls we've called the central plain. It may seem crazy to use the word plain to describe something so obviously curved, but we feel it's justified. It will appear flat to us when we get down there, just as the interior of a bottle must seem flat to an ant crawling around inside it. The most striking feature of the central plain is the 10-kilometer-wide dark band running completely around it at the halfway mark. It looks like ice, so we've christened it the Cylindrical Sea. Right out in the middle, there's a large oval island, about 10 kilometers long and 3 wide, and covered with tall structures. Because it reminds us of old Manhattan, we've called it New York. Yet, I don't think it's a city. It seems more like an enormous factory or chemical processing plant. But there are some cities, or at any rate, towns, at least 6 of them. If they were built for human beings, they could each hold about 50,000 people. We've called them Rome, Peking, Paris, Moscow, London, Tokyo. They are linked with highways and something that seems to be a rail system. There must be enough material for centuries of research in this frozen carcass of a world. We've 4,000 square kilometers to explore, and only a few weeks to do it in. I wonder if we'll ever learn the answer to the 2 mysteries that have been haunting me ever since we got inside. Who were they? And what went wrong? The recording ended. On Earth and Moon, the members of the Rama Committee relaxed, then started to examine the maps and photographs spread in front of them. Though they had already studied these for many hours, Commander Norton's voice added a dimension no pictures could convey. He had actually been there, had looked with his own eyes across this extraordinary inside-out world, during the brief moments while its age-long night had been illuminated by the flares. And he was the man who would lead any expedition to explore it.
Dr. Pereira, I believe you have some comments to make.
Ambassador Bowes wondered briefly if he should have given the floor first to Professor Davidson, as senior scientist and the only astronomer. But the old cosmologist still seemed to be in a mild state of shock and was clearly out of his element. All his professional career, he had looked upon the universe as an arena for the titanic, impersonal forces of gravitation, magnetism, radiation. He had never believed that life played an important role in the scheme of things, and he regarded its appearance on Earth, Mars, and Jupiter as an accidental aberration. But now, there was proof that life not only existed outside the solar system, but also had scaled heights far beyond anything that man had achieved or could hope to reach for centuries to come. Moreover, the discovery of Rama challenged another dogma that Davidson had preached for years. When pressed, he would reluctantly admit that life probably did exist in other star systems, but it was absurd, he had always maintained, to imagine that it could ever cross the interstellar gulfs. Perhaps the Ramans had indeed failed, if Commander Norton was correct in believing that their world was now a tomb. But at least they had attempted the feat, on a scale that indicated a high confidence in the outcome. If such a thing had happened once, it must surely have happened many times in this galaxy of 100 billion suns, and someone, somewhere, would eventually succeed. This was the thesis, that, without proof, but with considerable arm-waving, Dr. Carlyle Pereira had been preaching for years. He was now a very happy man, though also a most frustrated one. Rama had spectacularly confirmed his views, but he could never set foot inside it, or even see it with his own eyes. If the devil had suddenly appeared and offered him the gift of instantaneous teleportation, he would have signed the contract without bothering to look at the small print.
"Yes, Mr. Ambassador, I think I have some information of interest. What we have here is undoubtedly a space ark. It's an old idea in the astronautical literature. I've been able to trace it back to the British physicist J. D. Bernal, who proposed this method of interstellar colonization in a book published in 1929. Yes, 200 years ago. And the great Russian pioneer Tsiolkovsky put forward somewhat similar proposals even earlier. If you want to go from one star system to another, you have a number of choices. Assuming that the speed of light is an absolute limit, and that's still not completely settled, despite anything you may have heard to the contrary."
There was an indignant sniff, but no formal protest from Davidson.
"You can make a fast trip in a small vessel, or a slow journey in a giant one. There seems no technical reason why spacecraft cannot reach 90% or more of the speed of light. That would mean a travel time of 5 to 10 years between neighboring stars. Tedious, perhaps, but not impracticable, especially for creatures whose lifespans might be measured in centuries. One can imagine voyages of this duration carried out in ships not much larger than ours. But perhaps such speeds are impossible with reasonable payloads. Remember, you have to carry the fuel to slow down at the end of the voyage, even if you're on a one-way trip. So it may make more sense to take your time. 10,000, 100,000 years. Bernal and others thought this could be done with mobile worldlets a few kilometers across, carrying thousands of passengers on journeys that would last for generations. Naturally, the system would have to be rigidly closed, recycling all food, air, and other expendables. But, of course, that's just how the Earth operates, on a slightly larger scale. Some writers suggested that these space arcs should be built in the form of concentric spheres. Others proposed hollow, spinning cylinders, so that centrifugal force could provide artificial gravity. Exactly what we've found in Rama.
Davidson could not tolerate this sloppy talk.
"No such thing as centrifugal force. It's an engineer's phantom. There's only inertia."
"You're quite right, of course," admitted Pereira.
"Though it might be hard to convince a man who'd just been slung off a carousel, but mathematical rigor seems unnecessary."
"Hear, hear," interjected Bose,
with some exasperation. We all know what you mean, or think we do. Please don't destroy our illusions.
Well, I was merely pointing out that there's nothing conceptually novel about Rama, though its size is startling. Men have imagined such things for 200 years. Now, I'd like to address myself to another question. Exactly how long has Rama been traveling through space? We now have a very precise determination of its orbit and its velocity. Assuming that it's made no navigational changes, we can trace its position back for millions of years. We expected that it would be coming from the direction of a nearby star, but that isn't the case at all. It's more than 200,000 years since Rama passed near any star, and that particular one turns out to be an irregular variable, about the most unsuitable sun you could imagine for an inhabited solar system. It has a brightness range of over 50 to 1. Any planets would be alternately baked and frozen every few years.
A suggestion, put in Dr. Price. Perhaps that explains everything. Maybe this was once a normal sun and became unstable. That's why the Ramans had to find a new one.
Pereira admired the old archaeologist, so he let her down lightly. But what would she say, he wondered, if he started pointing out the instantly obvious in her own specialty?
We did consider that, he said, gently. But if our present theories of stellar evolution are correct, this star could never have been stable, could never have had life-bearing planets. So Rama has been cruising through space for at least 200,000 years, and perhaps for more than a million. Now, it's cold and dark and apparently dead, and I think I know why. The Ramans may have had no choice. Perhaps they were indeed fleeing from some disaster, but they miscalculated. No closed ecology can be 100% efficient. There is always waste, loss, some degradation of the environment and buildup of pollutants. It may take billions of years to poison and wear out a planet, but it will happen in the end. The oceans will dry up, the atmosphere will leak away. By our standards, Rama is enormous, yet it is still a very tiny planet. My calculations, based on the leakage through its hull and some reasonable guesses about the rate of biological turnover, indicate that its ecology could survive for only about 1,000 years. At the most, I'll grant 10,000. That would be long enough, at the speed Rama is traveling, for a transit between the closely packed suns in the heart of the galaxy. But not out here, in the scattered population of the spiral arms. Rama is a ship that exhausted its provisions before it reached its goal. It's a derelict, drifting among the stars. There's just one serious objection to this theory, and I'll raise it before anybody else does. Rama's orbit is aimed so accurately at the solar system that coincidence seems ruled out. In fact, I'd say it's now heading much too close to the sun for comfort. Endeavour will have to break away long before perihelion to avoid overheating. I don't pretend to understand this. Perhaps there is some form of automatic terminal guidance still operating, steering Rama to the nearest suitable star ages after its builders died. And they are dead. I'll stake my reputation on that. All the samples we've taken from the interior are absolutely sterile. We've not found a single microorganism. As for the talk you may have heard about suspended animation, you can ignore it. There are fundamental reasons why hibernation techniques will work for only a few centuries, and we're dealing with time spans a thousandfold longer. So the Pandorans and their sympathizers have nothing to worry about. For my part, I'm sorry. It would have been wonderful to have met another intelligent species. But at least we have answered one ancient question. We are not alone. The stars will never again be the same to us.
10. Descent into Darkness. Commander Norton was sorely tempted, but, as captain, his first duty was to his ship. If anything went badly wrong on this initial probe, he might have to run for it. So that left his second officer, Lieutenant Commander Mercer, as the obvious choice. Norton willingly admitted that Carl was better suited for the mission. The authority on life support systems, Mercer had written some of the standard textbooks on the subject. He had personally checked out innumerable types of equipment, often under hazardous conditions, and his biofeedback control was famous. At a moment's notice, he could cut his pulse rate by 50% and reduce respiration to almost zero for up to 10 minutes. This useful little trick had saved his life on more than one occasion. Yet, despite his great ability and intelligence, he was almost wholly lacking in imagination. To him, the most dangerous experiments or missions were simply jobs that had to be done. He never took unnecessary risks, and he had no use at all for what was commonly regarded as courage. The two mottos on his desk summed up his philosophy of life. One asked, "What have you forgotten?" The other said, "Help stamp out bravery." The fact that he was widely regarded as the bravest man in the fleet was the only thing that ever made him angry. Given Mercer, that automatically selected the next man, his inseparable companion, Lieutenant Joe Calvert. It was hard to see what the two had in common. The lightly built, rather highly strung navigation officer was 10 years younger than his stolid and imperturbable friend, who certainly did not share his passionate interest in the art of the primitive cinema. But no one can predict where the lightning will strike, and years ago, Mercer and Calvert had established an apparently stable liaison. That was common enough. Much more unusual was the fact that they also shared a wife back on Earth, who had borne each of them a child. Norton hoped that he could meet her one day. She must be a most remarkable woman. The triangle had lasted for at least 5 years, and still seemed to be an equilateral one. Two men were not enough for an exploring team. Long ago it had been found that three was the optimum, for if one man was lost, two might still escape, where a single survivor would be doomed. After a good deal of thought, Norton had chosen Technical Sergeant Willard Myron, a mechanical genius who could make anything work, or design something better if it wouldn't. Myron was the ideal man to identify alien pieces of equipment. On a long sabbatical from his regular job as associate professor at Astrotech, the sergeant had refused to accept a commission on the grounds that he did not wish to block the promotion of more deserving career officers. No one took this explanation seriously, and it was generally agreed that Will rated zero for ambition. He might make it to space sergeant, but he would never be a full professor. Myron, like countless NCOs before him, had discovered the ideal compromise between power and responsibility. as they drifted through the last airlock and floated out along the weightless axis of Rama, Calvert found himself, as he so often did, in the middle of a movie flashback. He sometimes wondered if he should attempt to cure himself of this habit, but he could not see that it had any disadvantages. It could make even the dullest situations interesting, and who could tell? One day it might save his life. He would remember what Fairbanks or Connery or Hiroshi had done in similar circumstances. This time, he was about to go over the top, in one of the early 20th century wars. Mercer was the sergeant, leading a three-man patrol on a night raid into no man's land. It was not too difficult to imagine that they were at the bottom of an immense shell crater, though one that had somehow become neatly tailored into a series of ascending terraces. The crater was flooded with light from three widely spaced plasma arcs, which gave an almost shadowless illumination over the whole interior. But beyond that, over the rim of the most distant terrace, were darkness and mystery. In his mind's eye, Calvert knew perfectly well what lay there. First, there was the flat circular plain over a kilometer across. Trisecting it into three equal parts, and looking much like broad railroad tracks, were three wide ladders, their rungs recessed into the surface so that they would provide no obstruction to anything sliding over them. Since the arrangement was completely symmetrical, there was no reason to choose one ladder rather than another. That nearest to Airlock Alpha had been selected purely as a matter of convenience. Though the rungs of the ladders were uncomfortably far apart, that presented no problem. Even at the rim of the hub, half a kilometer from the axis, gravity was still barely 1/30th of Earth's. Although they were carrying almost 100 kilos of equipment and life support gear, they would be able to move easily, hand over hand. Commander Norton and the backup team accompanied them along the guide ropes that had been stretched from Airlock Alpha to the rim of the crater. Then, beyond the range of the floodlights, the darkness of Rama lay before them. All that could be seen in the dancing beams of the helmet lights was the first few 100 meters of the ladder, dwindling away across a flat and otherwise featureless plain. And now, Mercer told himself, I have to make my first decision. Am I going up that ladder or down it? The question was not a trivial one. They were still essentially in zero gravity, and the brain could select any reference system it pleased. By a simple effort of will, Mercer could convince himself that he was looking out across a horizontal plane or up the face of a vertical wall, or over the edge of a sheer cliff. Not a few astronauts had experienced grave psychological problems by choosing the wrong coordinates when they started on a complicated job. Mercer was determined to go head first, for any other mode of locomotion would be awkward. Moreover, that way he could more easily see what was in front of him. For the first few 100 meters, therefore, he would imagine he was climbing upward. Only when the increasing pull of gravity made it impossible to maintain the illusion would he switch his mental directions 180 degrees. He grasped the first rung and gently propelled himself along the ladder. Movement was as easy as swimming along the seabed. Easier, in fact, for there was no backward drag of water. It was so easy that there was a temptation to go too fast, but Mercer was much too experienced to hurry in a situation as novel as this. In his earphones, he could hear the regular breathing of his two companions. He needed no other proof that they were in good shape, and wasted no time in conversation. Though he was tempted to look back, he decided not to risk it until they had reached the platform at the end of the ladder. The rungs were spaced a uniform half-meter apart, and for the first portion of the climb, Mercer missed the alternate ones. But he counted them carefully, and at around 200, noticed the first distinct sensations of weight. The spin of Rama was starting to make itself felt. At rung 400, he estimated that his apparent weight was about 5 kilos, or about 11 pounds. This was no problem, but it was getting hard to pretend that he was climbing when he was being firmly dragged upward. The 500th rung seemed a good place to pause. He could feel the muscles in his arms responding to the unaccustomed exercise, even though Rama was now doing all the work, and he had merely to guide himself.
"Everything okay, Skipper," he reported. "We're just passing the halfway mark. Joe, Will, any problems?"
"I'm fine. What are you stopping for?" Calvert answered.
"Same here," added Myron.
"But watch out for the Coriolis force. It's starting to build up."
So Mercer had already noticed. When he let go of the rungs, he had a distinct tendency to drift off to the right. He knew perfectly well that this was merely the effect of Rama's spin, but it seemed as if some mysterious force was gently pushing him away from the ladder. Perhaps it was time to start going feet first, now that down was beginning to have a physical meaning. He would run the risk of a momentary disorientation.
"Watch out, I'm going to swing around."
Holding firmly to the rung, he used his arms to twist himself around 180 degrees, and found himself momentarily blinded by the lights of his companions, far above them, and now it really was above, he could see a fainter glow along the rim of the sheer cliff. Silhouetted against it were the figures of Norton and the backup team, watching him intently. They seemed very small and far away, and he gave them a reassuring wave. He released his grip and let Rama's still feeble pseudo-gravity take over. The drop from one rung to the next required more than 2 seconds. On Earth, in the same time, a man would have fallen 30 meters. The rate of fall was so painfully slow that he hurried things up a trifle by pushing with his hands, gliding over spans of a dozen rungs at a time, and checking himself with his feet whenever he felt he was traveling too fast. At rung 700, he came to another halt and swung the beam of his helmet lamp downward. As he had calculated, the beginning of the stairway was only 50 meters below. A few minutes later, they were on the first step. It was a strange experience, after months in space, to stand upright on a solid surface, and to feel it pressing against one's feet. Their weight was still less than 10 kilograms, but that was enough to give a feeling of stability. When he closed his eyes, Mercer could believe that he once more had a real world beneath him. The ledge, or platform from which the stairway descended, was about 10 meters wide, and curved upward on each side until it disappeared into the darkness. Mercer knew that it formed a complete circle, and that if he walked along it for 5 kilometers, he would come right back to his starting point, having circumambulated Rama. At the fractional gravity that existed here, however, real walking was impossible. One could only bound along in giant strides, and therein lay danger. The stairway that swooped down into the darkness, far below the range of their lights, would be deceptively easy to descend. But it would be essential to hold on to the tall handrail that flanked it. too bold a step might send an incautious traveler arching far out into space. He would hit the surface again, perhaps 100 meters lower down. The impact would be harmless, but its consequences might not be, for the spin of Rama would have moved the stairway off to the left. And so a falling body would hit against the smooth curve that swept in an unbroken arc to the plain, almost 7 kilometers below. That, Mercer told himself, would be a hell of a toboggan ride. The terminal speed, even in this gravity, could be several 100 kilometers an hour. Perhaps it would be possible to apply enough friction to check such a headlong descent. If so, this might even be the most convenient way to reach the inner surface of Rama. But some very cautious experimenting would be necessary first.
Skipper, reported Mercer. There were no problems getting down the ladder. If you agree, I'd like to continue toward the next platform. I want to time our rate of descent on the stairway.
Norton replied without hesitation. Go ahead. He did not need to add, proceed with caution. It did not take Mercer long to make a fundamental discovery. It was impossible, at least at this 1/20th of a gravity level, to walk down the stairway in the normal manner. Any attempt to do so resulted in a slow-motion, dreamlike movement that was intolerably tedious. The only practical way was to ignore the steps and to use the handrail to pull oneself downward. Calvert had come to the same conclusion. This stairway was built to walk up, not down, he exclaimed. You can use the steps when you're moving against gravity, but they're just a nuisance in this direction. It may not be dignified, but I think the best way down is to slide along the handrail. That's ridiculous, protested Myron. I can't believe the Ramans did it that way. I doubt if they ever used this stairway. It's obviously only for emergencies. They must have had some mechanical transport system to get up here. A funicular, perhaps. That would explain those long slots running down from the hub. I always assumed they were drains, but I suppose they could be both. I wonder if it ever rained here.
Probably, said Mercer. But I think Joe is right, and to hell with dignity. Here we go.
The handrail, presumably it was designed for something like hands, was a smooth, flat, metal bar supported by widely spaced pillars a meter high. Mercer straddled it, carefully gauged the braking power he could exert with his hands, and let himself slide. Sedately, slowly picking up speed, he descended into the darkness, moving in the pool of light from his helmet lamp. He had gone about 50 meters when he called the others to join him. None of them would admit it, but they all felt like boys again, sliding down the banisters. In less than 2 minutes, they had made a kilometer descent in safety and comfort. Whenever they felt they were going too fast, a tightened grip on the handrail provided all the braking that was necessary. I hope you enjoyed yourselves, Norton called when they stepped off at the second platform. Climbing back won't be quite so easy.
That's what I want to check, replied Mercer,
who was walking experimentally back and forth, getting the feel of the increased gravity.
It's already 1/10 of a G here. You really notice the difference.
He walked, or more accurately glided, to the edge of the platform and shone his helmet light down the next section of the stairway. As far as his beam could reach, it appeared identical with the one above, though careful examination of photos had shown that the height of the steps steadily decreased with the rising gravity. The stair had apparently been designed so that the effort required to climb it was more or less constant at every point in its long, curving sweep. Mercer glanced up toward the hub of Rama, now almost 2 kilometers above him. The little glow of light and the tiny figures silhouetted against it seemed horribly far away. For the first time, he was glad that he could not see the whole length of this enormous stairway. Despite his steady nerves and lack of imagination, he was not sure how he would react if he could see himself like an insect crawling up the face of a vertical saucer more than 16 kilometers high, and with the upper half hanging above him. Until this moment, he had regarded the darkness as a nuisance. Now, he almost welcomed it.
"There's no change of temperature," he reported to Norton. "Still just below freezing, but the air pressure is up, as we expected, around 300 millibars. Even with this low oxygen content, it's almost breathable. Farther down, there will be no problems at all. That will simplify exploration enormously. What a find. The first world on which we can walk without breathing gear. In fact, I'm going to take a sniff."
Up on the hub, Norton stirred a little uneasily, but Mercer, of all men, knew exactly what he was doing. He would already have made enough tests to satisfy himself. Mercer equalized pressure, unlatched the securing clip of his helmet, and opened it a crack. He took a cautious breath, then a deeper one. The air of Rama was dead and musty, as if from a tomb so ancient that the last trace of physical corruption had disappeared ages ago. Even Mercer's ultra-sensitive nose, trained through years of testing life support systems to and beyond the point of disaster, could detect no recognizable odors. There was a faint, metallic tang, and he suddenly recalled that the first men on the moon had reported a hint of burned gunpowder when they repressurized the lunar module. Mercer imagined that the moon dust contaminated cabin of Eagle must have smelled rather like Rama. He sealed the helmet again and emptied his lungs of the alien air. He had extracted no sustenance from it. Even a mountaineer, acclimatized to the summit of Everest, would die quickly here. But a few kilometers farther down, it would be a different matter. What else was there to do here? He could think of nothing, except the enjoyment of the gentle, unaccustomed gravity. But there was no point in growing used to that, since they would be returning immediately to the weightlessness of the hub.
"We're coming back, Skipper," he reported. "There's no reason to go farther, until we're ready to go all the way."
"I agree. We'll be timing you, but take it easy."
As he bounded up the steps, 3 or 4 at a stride, Mercer agreed that Calvert had been perfectly correct. These stairs were built to be walked up, not down. As long as one did not look back and ignored the vertiginous steepness of the ascending curve, the climb was a delightful experience. After about 200 steps, however, he began to feel some twinges in his calf muscles and decided to slow down. The others had done the same. When he ventured a quick glance over his shoulder, they were considerably farther down the slope. The climb was wholly uneventful, merely an apparently endless succession of steps. When they stood once more on the highest platform, immediately beneath the ladder, they were barely winded, and it had taken them only 10 minutes. They paused for another 10, then started on the last vertical kilometer. Jump, catch hold of a rung. Jump, catch. Jump, catch. It was easy, but so boringly repetitious that there was danger of becoming careless. Halfway up the ladder, they rested for 5 minutes. By this time, Their arms as well as their legs had begun to ache. Once again, Mercer was glad that they could see so little of the vertical face on which they were clinging. It was not too difficult to pretend that the ladder extended only a few meters beyond their circle of light, and would soon come to an end. Jump, catch a rung, jump. Then, quite suddenly, the ladder really ended. They were back in the weightless world of the Axis, among their anxious friends. The whole trip had taken under an hour, and they felt a sense of modest achievement. But it was much too soon to feel pleased with themselves. For all their efforts, they had traversed less than an eighth of that cyclopean stairway. 11. Men, women, and monkeys. Some women, Commander Norton had decided long ago, should not be allowed aboard ship. Weightlessness did things to their breasts that were too damn distracting. It was bad enough when they were motionless, but when they started to move, and sympathetic vibrations set in, it was more than any warm-blooded male should be asked to take. He was quite sure that at least one serious space accident had been caused by acute crew distraction after the transit of an unholstered lady officer through the control cabin. He had once mentioned this theory to Surgeon Commander Laura Ernst, without revealing who had inspired his particular train of thought. There was no need. They knew each other much too well. On Earth, years ago, in a moment of mutual loneliness and depression, they had once made love. Probably they would never repeat the experience. But could one ever be quite sure of that? Because so much had changed for both of them. Yet, whenever the well-built surgeon oscillated into the commander's cabin, he felt a fleeting echo of the old passion. She knew that he felt it, and both were happy. "Bill," she began, "I've checked our Mountaineers, and here's my verdict. Carl and Joe are in good shape, all indications normal for the work they've done. But Will shows signs of exhaustion and body loss. I won't bother you with the details. I don't believe he's been getting all the exercise he should, and he's not the only one. There's been some cheating in the centrifuge. If there's any more, heads will roll. Please pass the word."
"Yes, ma'am. But there's some excuse. The men have been working very hard."
"With their brains and fingers, certainly. But not with their bodies. Not real work in kilogram meters. And that's what we'll be dealing with if we're going to explore Rama."
"Well, can we?"
"Yes, if we proceed with caution. Carl and I have worked out a very conservative profile, based on the assumption that we can dispense with breathing gear below the second level. Of course, that's an incredible stroke of luck, and changes the whole logistics picture. I still can't get used to the idea of a world with oxygen. So we need to supply only food and water and thermosuits, and we're in business. Going down will be easy. It looks as if we can slide most of the way on that very convenient banister."
"I've got Chips working on a sled with parachute braking. Even if we can't risk it for the crew, we can use it for stores and equipment."
"Fine. That should do the trip in 10 minutes. Otherwise, it will take about an hour. Climbing up is harder to estimate. I'd like to allow 6 hours, including 2 one-hour periods. Later, as we get experience and develop some muscles, we may be able to cut this back considerably."
"What about psychological factors?"
"Hard to assess. In such a novel environment, darkness may be the biggest problem."
"I'll establish searchlights on the hub. Besides its own lamps, any party down there will always have a beam playing on it."
"Good. That should be a great help."
"One other point. Should we play safe and send a party only halfway down the stair and back, or should we go the whole way on the first attempt?
If we had plenty of time, I'd be cautious. But time is short, and I can see no danger in going all the way and looking around when we get there.
Thanks, Laura. That's all I want to know. I'll get the exec working on the